Human Services Budget Division will come to order. The discussion today is going to be an update on medical transportation, special medical transportation. And to begin with, I would invite Christine Reisdorf from the Department of Human Services to come forward. Ms. Reisdorf, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. I'll just give a few opening remarks, and I have a report and some other information for you. But just to back up, non-emergency medical transportation falls into two groups. The first one is access transportation, or ATS, and that includes bus, taxi, mileage, meals, and lodging. The other type is called Special Transportation Services, or STS. This is wheelchair, ambulatory, or stretcher transportation for people who are cognitively or physically disabled, and they need assistance getting to the desk of the provider. Just some history, the department did broker STS services from October of 2006 through January of 2008. And the ATS brokering by the state ended last July of 2009, and the brokering of the ATS in the metro area was taken over by the counties then last July 1st of 2009. So the department is not involved in any brokering at this time. One of the activities that we have taken on, and I think I was asked to report on, is we do have an oversight. Even I do have some handouts.
We'll get those distributed. Ms. Reisdorf, please continue.
So after the department lost its authority to broker for the STF level of service, we were concerned about the several areas within that service. And so we contracted with MNET to do an oversight activity. And the handout that you have is a summary of the findings of that oversight activity. All 105 of the STS providers received requests for trip logs submittal. 79 providers sent in trip logs. 26 providers did not send in documentation. We are requesting documentation for those 26 that did not submit information to us. Regarding the mileage piece that was checked, trips that matched GPS, 30% of the trips matched GPS, 37%. Were over the GPS mileage, 24% in the 1 to 2 miles over the GPS, and 13% were 3+ miles over the GPS. Green there is about 450 to 500,000 miles paid on a monthly basis. This is a physical concern for us. Then there are about 17% of the trips paid were under the GPS mileage. The other concern for us is the signing by state law. The providers are required to get a signature and a time from the provider when they bring the client to the desk of the provider. 54% of these reviewed had a good signature, and about 46% of the time there was a bad, no signature, a questionable signature of the provider. So this is a huge concern for us. This oversight activity has resulted in referral to the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Unit, has resulted in increased activity to our surveillance unit as far as looking at STS services.
Ms. Reisdorf, can you back up just a little bit? And there was a bulletin that the department sent out to counties and local jurisdictions. It's dated January 13th, 2010. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about what was contained in the bulletin, what was the impetus behind sending the bulletin out, and what changes you were seeking to make or to clarify in that document. I know members have received lots of feedback and lots of questions that seemingly stemmed from what was contained in that bulletin, and perhaps if you could help us to better understand what you were trying to accomplish with that, that would be helpful.
Members, the bulletin that we sent out, we were getting a lot of requests from counties to clarify the differences between special transportation services and access transportation services, and also to give them some guidance around the ATS service. In non-metro counties, I think the coordination of ATS services is a huge challenge for counties. They struggle with it, and they don't have the staff or ability to manage the ATS services. And they were looking for some guidance, particularly around the payment issue. If you see on page 6 there, we give them an idea as to what the ATS rates are in the metro area. And so this was some guidance for the counties as how to manage and coordinate the ATS services and to let them know what payment rates they could pay to providers on the ATS side of things, because ATS services are not as available in the rural areas as they are in the metro area.
Concerns that as a result of the bulletin that was issued, there's seemingly an increase in volume and an increase in concerns surrounding ATS in the outlying areas. Can you help us to understand why that might be, or what the connection might be between that concern and this bulletin?
Madam Chair, I'm not the one concern that I know of regarding this bulletin is our clarification on the no-load miles for volunteers, that I think some counties have been paying volunteer mileage when the client was not in the vehicle, and we clarified that. That's the major concern that I know of.
We'll have an opportunity to hear from some of the counties a bit later in the testimony, and so that might shed some light on this as well. Your use of the term fraud is a pretty strong statement. Many months ago, there were conversations about the desire to utilize computerized mileage. And some members felt that would be a more streamlined process and one that was less open to question. My recollection is that the department was unable to accommodate that. And I wondered if you'd like to provide some comment on the use of computerized mileage, and if that, if the position of the department has changed in light of this information.
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. We would not be able to adjudicate claims based on a GPS or a mileage or a computerized mileage, because when the claims come in, we would have to know what the person's address is and the address of the place that they're taking in order to compute a GPS system for a mileage as the claim came in. So we would not be able to use a GPS system within our claims adjudication system. We rely on the providers to use a GPS system for the most direct route when they're billing us for services.
Mercer, as we go through this, certainly if you've got questions or comments that you want to interject, we can take questions as we move along through the discussion. Ms. Reister, do you have anything further to share with the committee at this time?
Madam Chair, I was asked to give to compile some information on the level of need process. Some of that I wasn't able to get it specific to county, but to give you some summary data on a level of need process. Currently, the numbers of level needs that are being done on a monthly basis range from about 210 to 350 level of needs on a monthly basis, averaging about 250 a month. About 50% to 70% of those level of needs are approved. So of those 80 to 100 or so that are denied, we receive about 8 to 10 appeals on a monthly basis. Of those 8 to 10 appeals on a monthly basis, about two-thirds of them are upheld, and a third of those appeals are reversed. The level of need process, the recipient or the client calls in, over half of the time, the information that the recipient gives us, the level of need or the MNET goes to the physician to document and confirm the person's diagnosis or condition. So that information is confirmed by the person's physician, about over half of the level of needs that come into the department.
And Ms. Reister, how often does someone need to be qualified under a level of need, or how long is that level of need decision in place?
Madam Chair, members, we can go out as far as 7 years. So when someone it's indicated, documented that they will need this service, as long as they're on our programs, we can give them up to 7 years. Sometimes if it's a short-term thing, we'll give a 6 month to a year. But it's an individual case-by-case length of time.
Ms. Reisdorf, do you have information on increases or changes in the levels of service? That is, do you have information that would better illustrate how ATS has grown or not grown over time? And the same of STS.
Madam Chair, I don't have specifics with me. I know that in the metro area, as a result of the brokering coordination of ATS, ATS has tripled in the metro area. A lot more people are receiving assistance with non-emergency medical transportation in the metro area. As far as the costs of STS goes, it reached its peak in about 2002 with about close to $25 million a year on the fee-for-service side being spent on STS. In 2008, it was down to about $13 million. That's the most recent that I have. I think that after hearing from counties, I know that the need for ATS is increasing, and so the challenge to offer that and manage that and coordinate that is just going to increase as the population ages. And I know that the counties and the rural areas struggle with that.
Ms. Reisdorf, if I'm a client or a patient and it's necessary for me to use a wheelchair, am I an STS client or am I an ATS client?
Madam Chair, members, you could be either or. There are people in wheelchairs who are capable of getting onto buses or into metro mobility transfers, many people who are in wheelchairs. So what it gets down to is that is the person, whether they're ambulatory or non-ambulatory, are they able to get themselves to the desk of the provider? Many people are unable to do that. There are some people in wheelchairs who are able to do that.
Senator Lynch?
Senator Sharon.
I would like to go back to your mentioning that you're hearing from the counties in the rural part of the state. I think you said that they're getting overwhelmed with ATS and needing some assistance. Did I understand you to say that correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Aaron, yes, we are hearing from rural counties that they do struggle with coordination of the ATS services.
Can you help the committee understand what the coordination of ATS services means and what the county, what you understand or what you've requested the counties to do in relationship to that?
Ms. Reisdorf.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, part of the coordination is on the front end, getting to deciding what level of service a person needs. There are people who can have vehicles or have friends who have vehicles, family members, and they may be able to transport or get a ride to the physician. Some people need more assistance getting to the provider. So it's a matter of the coordination means kind of assessing what level of transport that person needs. And then the other part of it, too, is that we have the responsibility to transport that person to the closest appropriate facility. We know that there are people traveling over 100 miles to go to a podiatrist when there's a podiatrist 3 miles from the person's house. We know there are people traveling and bypassing major medical centers to go to someplace else and when there's a facility, appropriate facility, much closer. So I think it's assessing that the person's need, where is the closest provider that person needs to see, and then arranging for that level of service that person may need. In the metro area, STS providers are also ATS providers. However, in the rural areas, the STS providers by a great margin are not also ATS providers.
And Senator Lynch, this description of the level of service needed so that it's the least expensive, that's workable within the capacity of the person, that they may need more assistance, which I think is interesting, why they'd be on ATS if that's the case, and that the transport to the closest appropriate level of service. Are those changes in the recent months, or has that been in place for a very long time?
Ms. Reisdorf.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, those guidelines have been around for quite a long time.
So there really
Senator
isn't a
Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. There really is not a change then in what the responsibilities are of the county. So what has changed that creates this concern?
Ms. Reisdorf.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think that probably prior to 5 or 6, 7 years ago, we weren't hearing much about this. But I think that as the years have gone by and the increase in access in the metro area has kind of caused a ripple effect. And I think also that the need for non-emergency medical transportation has increased as the population ages. The numbers of people who are disabled on our program increases. And so I think that the need has been increasing, that all counties, I think, are experiencing more questions about wanting reimbursement for mileage, wanting bus tokens, all the way up to the special transportation services.
Thank you. Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess I'm trying to get a handle on what we're really doing today. I'm assuming by looking at the agenda that we're still having problems in the medical transportation system.
Senator Coring, and you'll recall Senator Sharon had a series of meetings 15 months ago surrounding this issue area, and After the release of the bulletin that was referenced earlier, there's been an increasing number of questions and concerns that have resurfaced. And so this is an opportunity today to sort of get an update, see what has transpired since the series of meetings was held some 15 months ago. At that time and at the conclusion of many, many hours of discussion with stakeholders and the department, it was the feeling of the department that no statutory changes were necessary, and that while concerns had been identified, the thought was that those things would be further developed. And so today is kind of an opportunity to see what progress we've made and if there are some outstanding concerns out there. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, I think the other issue is that when we decided not to fund the brokering part of the service any longer, it wasn't our intention that we just shove it off for the counties to have to contract directly with the broker. Mm-hmm. It was our feeling that clients could be given a list of providers and arrange their own rides, and that isn't what's been happening. So I think that's part of the concern as well.
Senator Lynch,
Senator Sharon,
I'd like to add that just in context, the broker was in the metro area. Remember the two different services, ATS and STS. STS is a different subject in terms of arranging rides, but ATS was being brokered, arranged in the metro area, but not in the rural area. So this issue of having a broker to provide ATS services in the rural area was not ever in the conversation. Now, apparently, it has been introduced at some local levels because of something that's changing fairly recently.
And Madam Chair, so that's why I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. I know that just lately, this session, that things that the legislature and the governor has signed into law are not being followed by our various departments. And so I'm just trying to figure out if that's what's – is that what's happening here? And if so, if I need to get all cranked up today and get upset or what's going on. I'm serious. I thought this was taken care of. And so I guess I'm just trying to get a feel of what's going on. I just don't understand it.
Well, Senator Coring, I think that your questions and your confusion is – shared by many of us at this table. And so, members, I think at this time, maybe we can move through our testimony, and that might shed some further light, and then we'll reserve the opportunity to have Ms. Reisdorf rejoin our discussion after we hear from our testifiers. And with that, we'll ask that Peg Hegland come forward.
Good morning.
Ms. Hegland, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As it says on the agenda, I'm from Yellow Medicine County, which is a very small rural county. So I'm here to talk about some of the issues that are concerning us in the rural areas. You mentioned the bulletin that came out. We had had some prior discussions with the department about some of the issues in the bulletin. And I can tell you from a rural county perspective, probably the biggest thing for us was clarification by the department that they would no longer pay for what's called no-load miles. Just to clarify, a no-load mile means that the client is not in the vehicle with the volunteer. We have been paying no-load miles. And in the rural area, not being allowed to do this will cause us to lose substantially all our volunteers. What we're concerned about is when we have volunteers, for example, they may be traveling 10, 20 miles to pick up the client and then take them to that medical appointment. That 10, 20 miles will not be reimbursed to that volunteer any longer. We also have individuals who take clients to, for example, Rochester. Traveling from Granite Falls to Rochester is a four-hour drive. If that individual needs to stay for testing or medical treatment and therefore will be doing a one, two, three nights in Rochester, the volunteer goes home. That would not be reimbursed under this new clarification. So that's basically our main concern, is that our volunteers, if they're not being paid, we won't even have a volunteer to get individuals to the medical appointments. That clarification was made when the bulletin came out. That's why you're seeing so many questions that are arising right now. Another issue that I heard earlier was the fact that we're traveling past a podiatrist and taking someone to another podiatrist. I'd just like to point out that that's not, in my opinion, a transportation issue. That's a doctor issue. If the doctor in Granite Falls feels that, like, that client needs to go to the cities as opposed to Wilmer, that's twice the miles, but I'm not going to call the doctor and tell him that he cannot make that referral. So I'm not sure how to deal with that issue. That's a little bit outside our purview, but I just wanted to clarify that that's why that is occurring. It's not the transportation coordinator that's making that decision. That decision is coming directly from that individual's medical provider. For us, the no-load mile piece is, like I said, quite substantial. We're very concerned that we're going to be losing our volunteers due to that issue. We have been working with the Department of Human Services. In the past, what the current practice was is that the coordinator of the services, and in the metro, or excuse me, in the rural areas, some of the time it's the county actually coordinating that ride, having a staff on available for that. In other cases, we have just coordinators of services. For us, for example, they operate a 5-county volunteer transportation program that includes MnDOT, includes volunteer drivers, it includes the whole array of transportation services. We have been charging an administrative cost to pay for that service of coordination through a per mile charge. We've just been informed that we can no longer do that. And so what we're trying to do is work on another way of being able to actually bill back that administrative cost. Obviously, there are costs that come with actually coordinating the service, the staff time, the phone calls, et cetera. We're hoping to have a resolution with that, but at this point, we're still waiting for the department to come up with those instructions for us. Also working with the department to approach CMS about the possibility of considering our rural area an exception, and that paying for no-load miles is a good idea. We're working on some issues, but right now, what's happened since the bulletin came out is that it's been a cost shift. With the department no longer paying those no-load miles, or excuse me, with the state and federal government no longer paying those, counties have picked up that cost. We can do that for a month or two, but we're going to have time to that. So we're hoping that this can be resolved through some other means.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Ms. Hegland, I'm wondering, is it possible for volunteers to be paid a stipend? I mean, I don't know if we do that anymore, but I know we did do that at one time. And, I mean, I can understand why the department feels that Medicaid shouldn't be paying a driver for driving when they don't have a client in their car. But in the past, we used to pay stipends to volunteers, and that would sort of then help offset the additional costs they might have as a result of doing this volunteer service.
Ms. Hegland?
The concern with that is that volunteers are now monitored to the point where if they exceed a certain amount of payment, it becomes an IRS issue. One of the possibilities that we talked about was we just paid them more per loaded mile. However, if you exceed the IRS rate, which currently is 50 cents per mile, if they receive more than that 50 cents, anything over that is considered taxable income, and then we would get into that venue of having to call it taxable, et cetera, and they would have to file taxes on that.
Madam Chair. Senator Berglund.
Ms. Hagelin, I wasn't thinking of paying them more per mile when they do have a client in their car. I was talking about paying them a stipend in addition to the mileage.
I guess I would welcome the Department of Human Services to further look at that. Are you saying that would be billable back to medical assistance?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hagelin, well, I believe so. I mean, if a professional person is driving, that gets billed to medical assistance. And, you know, by using volunteers, it's always more cost effective. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like a volunteer stipend would be disallowed, but I think it's worth looking into.
And I agree.
Ms. Hagelin.
I agree. I think that it's something that we could ask Ms. Reisdorf to consider and to look into how we could do that, how that would be a possible billing piece for us.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would just have to say, from my perspective at least, I don't understand the department's position with regard to no-load miles, because when you pay someone, you're usually paying them for their costs and their time. And the cost of driving a vehicle, regardless of whether someone is in it or not, is the same. And the time involved in driving a vehicle, whether there's someone in it or not, is the same. And obviously, this is having a much greater impact on rural communities where you have a lot more miles that are now being uncompensated. So to me, I can't understand whatsoever the logic for not paying for no-load miles. And it just seems like a huge disproportionate way of taking money away from transportation in rural Minnesota as compared to the metro area. And I would like to understand better, is that a federal requirement that we're suddenly not paying? Is that something the state is requiring? Was that an administrative decision? Maybe I should already know that, but I'm wondering
if I could
understand that better.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Ms. Reisdorf.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, yes, we did. This is a federal issue. Just to make doubly sure, we did write to CMS on this specific issue, and they responded to us that we cannot pay for mileage when the person is not in the vehicle, whether it's a volunteer or a STS provider or a taxi or anything. They did suggest, I think as Peg suggested, that there, you know, that to increase the amount that we pay per mile to volunteers. But as she said, it does get into IRS, you know, tax considerations for the person. We can check to see about the stipend or a base rate for the volunteer, but I would assume that that's going to be the same tax consideration for these people as income, as the increased rate may be.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, Ms. Reisdorf, except that, you know, if they do have mileage expenses to subtract from whatever the stipend is, I mean, if they're actually making money on it, then they would have to claim it. But if they're, if they can show that their expenses are more than the stipend they're receiving, then they don't have to be paying taxes on it.
Sounds like the department's going to do some further follow-up on that, and if you could communicate back to the division, that would be appreciated. Ms. Hagelin, did you have something to add?
I was just going to comment that I appreciate that idea. It's a good one. My concern would be coming up with the appropriate amount depending on the transport. For example, a trip to Wilmer as opposed to a trip to Rochester, the stipend the same. That would be my concern as to how we would work that out.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Ms. Hagelin, wouldn't it seem like there could be some categories of time? So, you know, if you're driving somebody for 2 hours, you'd get this stipend. If you're driving and the time takes 4 hours, then you'd get a larger stipend.
Great. Senator Sharon.
Just to follow up on the other barrier here, is the 50 cents per mile, is it anything beyond 50 cents per mile is taxable?
Correct.
Is this 50 cents? Is this 50 cents per mile determined by rule, or is that legislated? I mean, can that number be changed without having to go through a lot of rigmarole?
Federal.
Is it a rulemaking that's occurring, or for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, are they making that rule, or is that determined in tax law at the federal level? Do you know?
Ms. Hegland.
I believe it's the federal IRS rate, and that's what transportation is based on. The bulletin that was alluded to has an entire list of who can get paid what amounts of money, and so I believe those come from the feds down to the states.
Ms. Hegland, thank you for your testimony and sharing. Dan Pappin. Mr. Pappin, welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Dan Pappin. I'm the Director of Community Services for Washington County. I'm here this morning not as an expert in transportation, but as a representative of the metro area counties, which due to the defunding of the transportation coordinator last year by the legislature, left counties responsible for the coordination of rides for medical assistance clients, specifically those not eligible for special STS services. So, and I do have to take this opportunity to point out that the increase in responsibility has been accompanied by a decrease in state aids as well. But due to the very quick timelines that we were under, all of the affected counties except for Wright agreed to a contract with the existing transportation coordinator at that time. And this contract has been managed very effectively on our behalf by Anoka County. We took this action for three basic reasons. We wanted to assure that clients, and it's about the clients, who rely on transportation for important medical purposes weren't lost in the shuffle of this, and that they were assured that the ride that they needed was going to be available to them. Second, because the coordinator had been doing this work for about 5 years, counties no longer had the necessary infrastructure and systems in place to assure that we could manage it effectively internally. And then finally, three, due to the rapid growth in the Medicaid program, counties now had significantly more cases, and at least in our situation, we don't have any additional staff. Our experience thus far with the coordinator of the services since July of last year has been favorable. In Washington County, we have had very few, if any, complaints from either clients or from the vendors, most of whom tell me that they are pleased with the interim solution, and it is an interim solution. My understanding about the complaints and the problems has been verified by other counties. Mr. Dan Engstrom is here from Hennepin County, and he can tell you the same is true in their situation. The current system does work, and it's an efficient way for us to coordinate this service. Participating counties are not committed to any one vendor. We are simply committed to having the function of coordinating the service done outside of the financial workers and the business that we of our shops. It's more efficient. It's more cost effective. The metro counties now, with the exception of Wright, are in the process of soliciting an RFP that has been issued, and we are awaiting responses to that RFP to select either the current coordinator or a different coordinator, depending upon the results of that RFP process. We are simply looking to hire the best coordinator available to manage the ATS system. We're doing it with our own money because we feel, as I said, it's the most cost-effective, most efficient way and responsible way for us to do our business. So with that, I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Questions from members. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. When we're talking about hiring a outside service to provide coordination services, are you talking about the same we're talking about choosing the least expensive system based on the capacity of the person on the you're talking about ATS rides. Are you talking about that assessment to determine if it should be a cab or a bus, or are you talking about determining whether or not they need more or less assistance? Are you talking about determining transportation to the closest appropriate level of service. Is that the responsibility that you're talking about for giving to MNET or some other broker?
Mr. Pappin.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what the counties do, that level of need that you've described has been done by an outside agency all along. So all the counties are responsible is after that level of need has been determined, paying for the coordination of that specific ride after that assessment, whether it's STS, ATS, bus system, whatever is ruled. So we only are paying for that component. We are not paying for the level of need, I believe.
Well, I may be confusing you in my question. The level of need assessment that determines whether it's ATS or STS services remains at the department level with their contracted server.
That's correct.
I'm talking about just for ATS services, where, as Reisdorf was talking about, what is the responsibility at the county level and under any circumstances. And what I understood her to say is that there is some assessment of the level of ATS service. Is it a bus or a taxi cab or something else, some other level? Because a person on ATS who is eligible might be able to take their wheelchair and get on a municipal transport system, a bus or something. So they would get a token as opposed to someone who might need to be in another kind of vehicle or take a ride of some sort. So those components of responsibility at the local level, are those what you're now needing to contract out? Or I'm just trying to understand what's different for you than for rural ATS counties that are managing it in the rural area.
Mr. Pappin.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, my understanding is once the determination has been made that the client needs an ATS ride level of service, that becomes the county's responsibility, and the coordinator of the system makes that decision about how that ride is to occur and who is to provide that ride.
Mr. Pappin, thank you for your testimony today. Dan Engstrom.
That's what they're contracting on. I forgot to ask him how much money
you spent. Mr. Engstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dan Engstrom. I'm the Assistant County Administrator in charge of Human Services and Public Health in Hennepin County. Over the years, Hennepin County has managed ATS access transportation services in several different ways. Back in the 70s and 80s, we managed it ourselves as a county. Back then, we had workers try and determine what was the most appropriate way that a person could get to a non-emergency medical transportation appointment. In Hennepin County, obviously, that would entail friends, relatives. We have buses, light rail, cabs, and metro mobility. Those are a lot of modes of transportation. At one point, we actually had a service level agreement with Metropolitan Health Plan, which is our health plan in Hennepin County. They managed this for us. They did an excellent job. They created used some technology that would streamline this and make this very efficient for the clients. As we heard, DHS has managed this effort, and we have the current arrangement with the current contracted vendor. In the metro area, by joining together with other counties to purchase this service, we really are trying to reduce the administrative burden of this service. We want to reduce any opportunities for fraud and abuse that might occur. But our most important goal is to preserve the improved client access to the service that we have really seen since we've had the state initiate the metro area contract. We have an ombudsperson in Hennepin County. That person reports directly to me. I have not heard a lot of complaints from our ombudsperson, from the other network of case managers that we have in Hennepin County. We've been satisfied with this service. In Hennepin County, we are about 43% of the rides for ATS. We're the majority of this. Last year, we surveyed I think in the fiscal note that was presented, we determined that if Hennepin County was to take this on ourselves again, as we had done in the past, that the fiscal note, I think, demonstrated it would cost us about $1.5 million, something like 17 FTEs in order to do this type of coordination in Hennepin County. Currently, our caseload, our cash caseload is up 4%. Our medical assistance caseload is up almost 10%. Food stamps or food support is up 35%. People seeking veteran services are up 41%. Even our mental health face-to-face crisis situations are up 68%. We would rather contract this out. We don't want to build this infrastructure. With FTEs, we want to use the precious FTEs we have to deal with the client demand that's coming in our office day in and day out. In terms of the transportation coordinator, I want to emphasize, and I think this was just discussed, that we feel there is a need to market and inform transportation services in the process and educate the client population that we deal with. We feel there's a need to maintain a call center and also have, at times, different languages that are available to help the process. We have a very diverse population in Hennepin County, and this can get very complicated in order to make this assessment in terms of what the most appropriate need for transportation services is. We need this verification of eligibility to make sure that a person is eligible on medical assistance. We want to make sure that the utilization is verified, that the person is going to the right trip and going to where they need to go for the non-emergency services. There are times when we need to arrange out-of-the-area transportation, and we need the training coordinator to handle that. We also feel it's important to establish and maintain provider enforce driver and provider performance standards. We want our clients having safe rides with people that are qualified. We also think that there's a need to have an adequate transportation provider network. We know that in this process there are required reports and electronic records that need to be maintained, and there's also a client right to appeals and complaints, and we need to have that type of administrative function work both accurately and effectively. So the Metro Counties, as you heard, are moving forward with an RFP. We hope to have a contract in place by July 1st, and we feel that given our experience over the years, this is the best approach for us to take.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Engstrom, do you think that having a more formalized mechanism of arranging rides for people tends to discourage people from getting friends or relatives to volunteer to give them a ride?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Engstrom.
I'm not sure. I think that we obviously want the most appropriate, most cost-effective mode of service to be provided for that client. And we don't want to make it onerous that that becomes difficult for the client to be able to figure that out. And we want that process to be smooth so that we know that it's the right form for the for their situation. So.
Well, Mr. Engstrom, Senator, I might just point out that while you might be contracting for somebody to broker and arrange the rides, the state still pays for the rides. And if it's more expensive for us to have somebody be given a professional ride than to have a family member drive a client, we need to worry about that.
I would agree,
Mr. Senator Engstrom.
I would agree. We want the most appropriate form and the most cost-effective form.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. In your RFP process, I have a series of questions, if I may.
Chair.
They are not necessarily connected. So the one of the issues that has been under a lot of discussion here at the state level, is an arm's-length transaction occurring between the interested parties doing the level of need assessment, and they're having an interest in the outcome of whether a person's at STS or ATS level of service. So in the process of discussing an RFP, are you considering arm's-length transactions between those two, selecting an RFP that, for the RFP, a person that's not involved in the level of need assessment?
Mr. Engstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator. Yes, we want that process to work that way.
Another question I would have is, quite frankly, I don't know how much you're willing to pay for this service, but it's a higher level of service, the question of whether it's necessary, I think, is debatable, since if a person's on ATS, they have a lot of competencies and capabilities, even though they need some supportive transportation to medical appointments. And so the challenge, I think, is to me to be persuaded that whether or not if the county wants to spend some money to do something at a higher level of service than the rural part of the state wants to provide, I think that ought to be the county's choice. But the issue for us was whether or not the state should be paying for a service that raises the service to an individual that they might be able to do on their own, and that would discourage their using their own family's resources to be able to do that. So, I think that what the counties choose to do is certainly it's on your ticket. So that's your decision.
Mr. Engstrom, thank you for your testimony. I would invite Judith Broomfield to come forward. Ms. Broomfield, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Judith Broomfield. I am the Deputy Director of Community Services in Scott County. And I was asked to come this morning to talk about a county that has chosen to do access transportation on our own. So I wanted to give you kind of a background and an explanation of what Scott County has chosen to do at this point in time. And as other county representatives have given you information, just the very brief background that in July we were required to take over again the ATS transportation facilitation. This was without sufficient notice to allow us really to set up a good program. It meant we took on administrative responsibilities that we had not had for a number of years, and at a time that we no longer had the infrastructure to maintain those responsibilities. We did an assessment in Scott County and recognized that it would take us a minimum of 2 FTEs to accomplish the responsibilities that were being turned back to us in July of 2009. We had to look at what we could reasonably do. We've had a 30% increase in our income maintenance services over the last few years without an increase in staff. Actually, we've had a decrease in staff. So we were at the point of making a decision, do we not put people on medical assistance, have longer waiting lists for that, longer waiting lists for food support, or do we take on the access transportation responsibilities? Given those decisions, we chose to join with the other 10 metro counties in having a contract with the current broker during a period of time that we could further assess whether or not this was something the county could do or whether we wanted to maintain a relationship with a broker. In August of 2009, Scott County and Carver County merged their public transit systems so that now we are operated as one system under one administration. Looking at that, we believe that there was a potential that our public transportation, our public transit, could take over the administration of the ATS program. So we worked with the Metro County contract through the end of 2009, and effective February 1st of 2010, we withdrew from that contract and began operating the ATS program with the county. Obviously, that means we have a little over 1 month history at this point in time. But I can give you the reasons we chose to make that change and what the advantages we believe we will get out of that. I also need to be very clear that this is basically a brokerage model. We are having the services coordinated by our transit system. We are not doing this within our income maintenance division. They've been able to hire one person to manage the program for two counties. So therefore, that was cheaper than our ability to do it within our own staffing with income maintenance, and it did not decrease from the service to our clients who need to be on any kind of public assistance program. All calls for transportation of any kind, public transportation in Scott and Carver County, come into one call center. That decreases the pass off of a call from either a broker to a service provider, or in the event that it comes into the county directly, the county then needs to make the referral. So it eliminates one telephone call. It also allows the scheduling to happen for all public transportation on the same buses. So we have been able to combine ATS rides, STS rides, and dollar rides so that we have one bus providing all of these services, which is more efficient. Instead of having three buses to provide each of the three different services to an area, if those appointments can be coordinated, we can provide that on one bus throughout the county. Our system is able to work for a number of reasons. By merging the transit system of Scott and Carver counties, the total number of riders reaches a large enough number to be able to have a self-sustaining program. A single provider with fully handicapped accessible buses serves the total population. Our county population and demographics result in a very limited fixed route service availability. And both transit programs are human services county programs, and therefore we have the merging of various departments able to provide this kind of service. We also historically have an excellent service relationship between our transit and our human services department. The Met Council has supported this initiative. They're watching it closely to see about the effectiveness of the program. If we're successful with our program, we're able to demonstrate fiscal accountability, a high level of service, and the efficiency of braiding multiple funding programs and moving away from the silos that we currently have, where, for example, the Department of Human Services provides medical transportation, the Met Council in the metro area has responsibility for public transportation. We're able to use one bus service for all of the populations needing transportation. We're excited about this as a potential. We do see this as something that can work in Scott and Carver counties. It is not necessarily a program that can work throughout the state. In the greater Minnesota area, where they have a much smaller population and perhaps a much wider transportation area, this would not be cost-effective to try and do this kind of program. In the more compressed metro area, like Hennepin and Ramsey County, that has a very, very wide network of fixed route services. Again, this would not be cost effective to use this model. I do need to stress, when we talked about the requirements for ATS and the administration of that, it does mean when that user calls in, we have to clarify, do you have a car that you could use? Do you have a neighbor or friend who could provide transportation? Are you on a fixed route where you could utilize that? So that is a requirement to go through all of those things. It's also a requirement then to look at whether or not the vendor was the closest potential vendor. And if it's not the closest potential vendor, obviously you get into the issue of, do they have a choice? Or is this something where their doctor is recommending this particular vendor? Then you have to verify that the ride actually occurred. You have to process payment back to that client, and then you need to bill the state to get your own reimbursement. This is not an easy process. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. And we fully believe that whether you use a broker, whether you use a single administrative source, as Scott and Carver County have done, that that is the most cost-effective way of providing this program. Rather than have individual financial assistance case managers having to do this again and again for a number of different clients. Thank you.
Ms. Brumfield, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Delaine Reams. Ms. Reams, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Delaine Remish, and I work with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm a legal advocate in the Mankato office and serve southern Minnesota. I'm here today to talk specifically about special transportation and individuals in wheelchairs with severe disabilities in rural Minnesota. However, I would like to first just clarify I've become familiar with the level of need assessment done by MNET, and to clarify in regards to the question that Senator Berglund asked two speakers previously regarding family rides and ATS transportation, in that level of need assessment, I am aware there's a question that says, how do you get to the grocery store, to other locations, and if they do check, you know, a family member or a friend gets me there, I think that is part of their assessment within that level of need as to whether they have another option to get transportation. And in the area of STS in rural Minnesota, I've handled about 17 cases in the last year and a half, and 9 of them have gone through appeal hearings. And specifically, these individuals live in rural Minnesota, small towns, Wabasha, Windham, Mankato, Sherburn, Popaski, Wadena. And these individuals have severe disabilities. Just to give you a few examples, one person has spastic quadriplegia with cerebral palsy, profound mental retardation, and seizure disorders. A person who's a quadriplegic, another individual has cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and severe mental illness. And so the cases that I accept typically are individuals with severe disabilities, and again, 100% are wheelchair users. The calls that our agency is getting are increasing, and of these 17 cases I've handled, 9 of them have gone to appeals. Of those 9, we've had 7 favorable decisions, and of those 7 favorable decisions, all the last 5 have occurred in the last 3 months, and I have 3 more on my desk waiting to be reviewed for evaluation. So I'm seeing an increase in the calls. I only accept cases where I first look at if there are other options for transportation for those individuals. And the primary issues, the primary issues are, from our understanding, is that in the eligibility process, MNET and DHS are misreading and misinterpreting the medical transportation statute. These individuals have PCAs or parents who have to provide them with CARES, and MNET and DHS are denying them eligibility based on the fact that those individuals are there to help maybe get a person through a door or help them to the van. MNET and DHS are using the duties of the STS drivers kind of as an additional eligibility criteria requirement for the recipients. So these So if a person has a PCA and need that PCA to be with them during transport, whether they have seizures or a medical condition, MNET and DHS are denying them because that PCA can push them to the van or can open doors for them. It's kind of a very specific population that they're denying, but they are the most severely disabled folks who really need this level of transportation. In rural Minnesota, when you look at the idea of STS or ATS providers, there is limited to no wheelchair-accessible ATS providers in rural Minnesota. The ATS providers are majority of the time volunteer drivers from the counties, as you've heard a couple examples. And when there is transportation that's wheelchair-accessible, it's limited to city limits or county limits. So a person with these profound disabilities who has cerebral palsy and needs to go to their neurologist, you know, the family clinic in Wabasha or Wabasso, or Sherburn, Minnesota, doesn't have a neurologist that can see them for that specialty care that they need once every 6 months or sometimes even once a year. or they don't have a wound clinic specialist to help somebody with a spinal cord injury who's a quadriplegic. So oftentimes their rides are out of area transportation that they can't get to in their local city or county. So STS is necessary to provide them with their necessary medical care. MNET or DHS really makes no inquiry as far as what other available transportation services there are. And in the rural Minnesota, it's my understanding that that level of need assessment that's going through MNET really needs to take a look at that. I've got a few suggested changes. First one would be to separate the eligibility criteria for STS from the duties of the STS driver. In all the appeals I've been successful for, the arguments are very clear that the client's disabilities make them eligible for the service because they can't stand, transport themselves, open a door, or move their own wheelchair oftentimes to get through a door. If a PCA or a parent is helping them open a door, they still need that level of assistance. And so to separate the driver duties from what really the eligibility criteria of that individual is. So that would be my first recommendation, is to separate that eligibility criteria. Second is to specify in the statute that the level of need assessment really needs to assess, to evaluate the abilities and the limitations of the individual. In the statute, the only thing under eligibility says, can the person safely access and use common carriers or private automobiles? None of these individuals can safely access because there's no ATS wheelchair accessible transportation available to get them from their home to their medical appointments. And if there is, if they're just going to a dentist right in their town and there's, in, like in Waseca, there's some wheelchair accessible city buses, they use that level. If they're going to a specialist in Rochester or Abbott Northwestern, specifically for medical cares, they don't go outside the city limits. Make sure that the level of need assessment verifies the disability and physical limitations by their medical care provider or physician or public health nurse, and discover whether there is safe, appropriate, accessible transportation available to the person to get to their location. The last suggestion would be to extend the certification period. I did an appeal a year ago, and the client called me back 9 months later and said, he's getting terminated again from STS. We won that appeal. The decision was reversed, and he was recertified for special transportation. And not even 12 months later, he called me back and said he's now being terminated from special transportation again. Many of these clients have severe disabilities like cerebral palsy, quadriplegia. They're not going to change. And maybe a doctor could put, they could add that level of need assessment. You know, it's not likely that this condition is going to change, recertify for full form or something.
Thank you, Ms. Remish. Senator Sharon.
I don't want to lose my thought because of what you said earlier when Ms. Reisdorf was here. We asked about the length of certification. This is a critical question, and the suggestion was that it could be up to 7 years, but the probability of 7 years is very low. Is that? And what you're describing now is a situation where you won an appeal process, they got recertified to STS, but they were only given a 9-month certification for a highly disabled person. This is one of the issues of concern, is that there is a fee associated with re-upping the person's STS or re-evaluating the level of need. And so there's a motivation for shorter periods of certification. There may be a motivation for that. And so I just want to make sure I heard you, that you went through the difficult and expensive process of an appeal. It was clearly demonstrated that the level of need was STS, and yet you're back in the same situation within 9 months.
Ms. Remish.
Madam Chair and members, yes, that is the case. It's been the case in 2 appeals that I've handled, where they have been certified, have won the appeal, and then have certification has ended. I can't try to explain why that's happening. I just get the call from the individual saying, Ms. Remish, my appeal is, or my transportation is being denied again.
And may I ask you,
Senator Sharon,
how much of your time is spent in these appeals, and what is the cost of your time to assist this?
Ms. Remish.
Uh, I've spent a lot of time in these appeals, and it's very close to my heart that these individuals get access to their doctors. I haven't figured my time in a income base. I'd like to just share one of my most recent appeals that we did this week. A gentleman is disability is he has a severe disability and he also has lung cancer. Oh, here it is, spinal stenosis and lung cancer. And he's at the advanced stages of lung cancer, and his primary physician is going through some medical problems of his own, and so he said you have to find so his oncologist said you have to find a primary physician for me to know how to proceed with your treatments for your cancer, because he's very limited in his abilities to move and to ambulate and to walk and has high levels of pain. And because of this, he hasn't been able to get to a primary physician for 3 months because of this appeal process. He's lost an immense amount of weight and has not been able to see his oncologist, and now has associated conditions, pressure sores and skin conditions that have been a result of that. And so in rural Minnesota, I asked for an expedited decision after the appeal hearing on Tuesday because of these conditions. But it's just so obvious that these individuals cannot independently get themselves to a vehicle and in a vehicle, and the reason they're being denied is because a PCA or a parent is helping them through a door. And so that level of disability that really needs and requires special transportation services when no other wheelchair access available is just eminent to their care and their health and well-being.
Senator Sheridan.
I'm sorry. I'm curious. Your services in representing this group are paid for in what way? Who pays for your time?
I work with the Minnesota Madam Chair and members, I work for the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And I'm a legal advocate.
Ms. Henry, welcome.
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, we get a variety of funding, but a substantial amount of federal funding. We also raise money through grants, but yes, we do get public money. And in terms of the earlier question about the time that Delaine spends, this is a key area for her, and it is a very serious problem. So it is costly to do this. I think it's also important to realize that it's costly at DHS to go through the appeal process up and down the line for people that clearly are eligible for the service.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. That's the point I'm trying to make. I think it might be worth in the audit, I don't know if we can expand the audit, but we ought to take a look at how much we're spending to go through the appeal processes and see if there isn't some cost savings that would occur from doing a better job as we've been trying and struggling around level of need assessment, rather than throwing people off of this when they need to be on it and having to go through these appeal processes.
Senator Sharon, I think you make a good point, and I was pleased to see that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is taking up this issue, and it is one of the things, one of their priorities in the upcoming year. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Remish. I'm just going to ask you for a little bit more information about this. As a lawyer, I haven't ever been involved in these kinds of cases, but I used to handle some Social Security disability hearings. And I know that in those kinds of situations, a lot of times the analysis is very formulaistic. You know, the people involved will feel that maybe sometimes to a certain degree their hands are tied by very formulaistic rules in how they do these evaluations. And it isn't until you get to a hearing where someone kind of talks through the practical side of what the implications of applying these rules are. And so I'm just wondering if you could be a little more specific, because I'm guessing that the concern is that we're not duplicating payment for two people doing the same thing. You know, so where we have STS services that's already paying someone to do something to assist the person, and where you have a PCA, you're also paying someone to do maybe what is being viewed as the same thing. And I'm guessing that kind of goes to the heart of what's causing these denials. Is there a question of there being a need for two people to deal with the person because of the level of service, or is it not quite that simple? Could you perhaps help us understand the fact scenarios and then maybe if there are some changes in how we're writing the laws or the rules that would change the way that these things are being analyzed, you know, to specifically look at? And you did make a suggestion, but maybe a little bit more specific.
Ms. Remish.
Madam Chair and members and Senator Olson, yes, I can comment on that. They are two separate services, and PCA is actually under the DHS definition are to accompany individuals on transportation and actually identify STS as one of them. They provide a separate service. In the level of need assessment and in the eligibility assessment, the reason they're being denied is because they're saying the driver doesn't have to assist them, which in form is accurate because a PCA can open the door or push them through a door or push them to the STS vehicle. However, in review of the statutes as they are, the eligibility criteria, again, is just safely access and use of common carrier for the individual. And later the statutes go into what is required by the provider and the driver. And
seizures and things that the driver can't handle. Seizures. And why do you need a PCA?
And PCAs, because they're providing different services, if a person's allocated 14 hours of PCA services a day, and you may be aware of this, they need that level of care for personal care, seizure monitoring, tube feeding, all of those personal cares, and a driver can't provide those while they're driving, nor are they trained to provide that service. And a PCA isn't trained to drive that vehicle, to secure that vehicle, and all of the requirements that go along with STS standard operating procedures.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think that helps to clarify. I think what you're saying in a nutshell, Ms. Remish, is that this person needs care while they're being driven. And so because that isn't contemplated as well as perhaps it could be in the statute right now, that you're what's causing the problem, because even though the STS driver can do things while they're not driving, they can't provide the level of care the person actually does need while they're being driven. So maybe that's what we need to address, is an assessment that would say, does this person require the assistance of a second person while they're being driven, but not at the level where they would have to be in an ambulance or something like that? And then perhaps that would help to get the appropriate people qualified, while not qualified other people who don't need that help while they're being driven.
Ms. Remish and Ms. Henry, I think this has been a really helpful part of the discussion, and I think the division would welcome your further comments on this, specifically if there are things that you think that perhaps we might want to give further consideration to with regard to how we might be able to clarify within the existing statute. I think that it's in everyone's best interest, the clients, the department, us representing people all across the state. If there's something that we can do to make this process more clear, it seems that might be helpful and a win-win for everyone. Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair, yes, we will follow up with some recommendations. I think that, you know, after looking very closely at this last night, I see what we need to do and where perhaps some of the problems are coming in for these very, very high-need folks. I would also just follow up in terms of the issue of whether people need assistance while being driven. It's also that people need assistance while waiting in the doctor's office, while going in.
Sure.
So it's just that the person needs someone with them, and I think we can clarify that, and we'll definitely get some language to you.
Thank you. Mr. Pinsky, you are anxious to join us.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you.
I
thought perhaps I could help answer Senator Olson's question from the transportation provider's perspective. the PCA is obviously hired to provide services to the client, and just as such, the driver is not allowed to pass meds to the client. The PCA is not allowed to load the client into the vehicle, operate the vehicle, or secure the individual in the vehicle. So insurance companies and or MnDOT rules and regulations would preclude the PCA from doing that in an STS vehicle. So I wanted to see if I could add that to the discussion.
Thank you. Don't go too far, Mr. Pinsky. Well, you're next on the agenda.
Yes, I understand that. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mike Pinsky. I'm the president of the Minnesota R80 Medical Transportation Coalition. We are an association of rural transportation STS providers providing services in the rural 80 Minnesota counties. In addition to that, I have owned and operated my own STS company based in Mankato since 1993. I am here this morning to address concerns raised by the recent DHS bulletin that was released in January of this year and to raise your awareness of the impact it will have on rural transportation providers and the access to medical services for rural recipients. The plans that the bulletin outlines for rural transit, in my opinion, are alarming. First, my biggest concern is that it shifts a tremendous amount of work to the counties and then ties their hands. For example, all counties will be responsible for fielding calls from recipients, calling providers to arrange transportation, receiving billing from providers, then the counties would bill DHS, receive payment from DHS, and in turn pay the provider. They have to do all this work, yet they have no say in the contracting rates with providers, and they have no say whatsoever in the level of need process. We recognize that the counties are under a tremendous amount of budget pressure and don't have the personnel to respond to this. It seems as though this bulletin has created a problem that only the broker or brokering agencies can solve statewide.
Senator Lynch,
Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Pinsky, but I want to go back to what you just said. And I want to make sure I understood what you said clearly, because I heard something, I thought I heard something that contradicted what you just said earlier.
Okay, sure.
And Senator that is Sharon. That you said in the bulletin there was a shift of responsibility to counties. That's a change in my mind. And I heard earlier that there was not a change in what the expectations were at the county level. So please help me understand that if there was a shift of expectations and responsibilities with all sorts of mandates associated with that, I could understand why counties were beginning to be agitated.
Sure.
But I'm trying to understand the agitation if there isn't really any shift, and where we heard in earlier testimony last year that the rural counties, this 80-county group, were managing ATS services in a very different way than they were in the metro area, and they were doing just fine.
Mr. Pinsky.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I would respond to that in saying that counties have always participated in providing some level of transportation services for a number of years. What has happened is a tremendous amount of burden has been pushed to them to coordinate the transportation now. For example, I've been in contact with several local counties in the service areas that I provide service in, and they have shown an interest in contracting with my services to provide some of these ATS services. One large difference that this particular county is implementing or pushing would be to simply refer the clients to the transportation provider. Once that referral is made, the transportation provider then would do all the eligibility verification, screen and receive all the phone calls, do all of the scheduling, do all of the dispatching, and simply in turn return a bill to that local county for that service, thus cutting out all of the phone calling, all of the screening, and a lot of the miscellaneous work that we as providers are already doing. And so I see that particular county as taking the lead in this in working with providers out there that quite honestly do serve as large regional providers and can help coordinate a lot of these services. For example, we are contracted with approximately a dozen HMOs, several counties, and the state of Minnesota. We have one staff that does the billing to all of those different entities, and we think that we run an efficient operation, that we're able to assist the counties, at least in my particular area, to overcome some of the burden. So I think part of the increase in the county, at least in the rural counties, their concern is due specifically to this bulletin, which has, for lack of a better word, changed some of the rules and some of the procedures as how this would work.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to continue, though.
Sure.
You know, we recognize the counties are in a difficult situation budget-wise. And we're obviously here to offer solutions to that as well. This bulletin in particular, one thing that it does is that Ms. Reisdorf said that it was an attempt to clarify the differences between STS and ATS. As a 17-year veteran of this industry, I can tell you that I'm more confused now than ever, and that this bulletin absolutely blurs the line between what special transportation and access transportation is. I believe this program will not work in the rural areas because it substantially increases the number of deadhead miles and non-reimbursable miles a provider must travel. This may in turn, this is why you don't have a large number of wheelchair-accessible ATS providers out in the rural area. This bulletin does not address transportation provider requirements for ATS providers. In fact, the bulletin refers to non-emergency taxi. I'm not quite sure what a non-emergency taxi. I think a non-emergency taxi would mean that there must be such a thing as an emergency taxi. What is a non-emergency taxi? In fact, taxis are regulated by municipalities, not by MnDOT. There is no such thing as a non-emergency taxi, in my opinion. Also, do we know if taxis are performing the required background checks, have the appropriate level of insurance, or the proper MnDOT certifications and or training? Finally, the biggest issue that we are facing as rural transportation providers is the fact that we believe strongly there is no such thing as ATS wheelchair transportation. Wheelchair transportation in Minnesota is regulated by either the State Patrol or MnDOT. According to this bulletin, now taxis are allowed to do wheelchair transportation without being certified by the Department of Public Safety or MnDOT. Wheelchair transportation is STS, according to MnDOT and the Department of Public Safety. As Ms. Remish has indicated, there seems to be a number of systemic problems with the level of need process. My observations as being a rural provider are that LONs, level of need assessments, are being performed more than once every 6 months, as Minnesota statute dictates that they're only performed once every 6 months. We see them being performed much more often than that. We also are seeing a trend where level of needs are being performed on ICFMR clients, and we understand it is our position that ICFMR clients are exempt from level of needs per Minnesota statute 62A.46 subdivision 3. Another disturbing issue is that how is a recipient downcoded from STS to ATS, appeals, gets reinstated to STS, is then downcoded again to ATS at their next level of need 6 months later. I have another situation regarding an ICFMR client. This recipient's been certified for special transportation for 17 years and has now been downcoded to ATS. They are 17 years older now. They reside at an ICFMR and are confined to a wheelchair. Either the certification was wrong for 17 years or it's been wrong for the last 6 months since it's been made. And we see that as an alarming trend. Something that was touched on earlier by Ms. Remish as well is why are recipients downcoded to ATS when they have staff ride with? Staff rides with for the safety of the recipient to monitor seizures, pass medications, monitor ventilators and behavioral outbursts, and to document and or chart what the doctor tells them is in the best needs of that particular recipient as prescribed by the Minnesota Department of Health. We as drivers are not allowed to go into the exam room with the clients and chart in their charts. So the staff needs, they are the guardian of that particular individual. They are not able, that the PCA or the staff are not able to perform any of the functions of the driver. Another concern is why are there gaps in coverage for a recipient when they go through the appeal process? Why is this not automatic? When they appeal, are they not automatically still eligible for the service they recently were denied from? And if they do get reinstated STS, there is a gap of coverage during that appeal took place where they are no longer eligible. I think that that needs to be just simply automatic. Why is there no MnDOT definition of ATS services in the state of Minnesota? Is it not MnDOT that should be regulating transit in Minnesota? How is it that common carriers can provide wheelchair transportation without certifications from MnDOT or the Department of Public Safety? Why are providers not allowed to bill DHS directly for ATS rides? Wouldn't giving ATS providers the ability to bill directly to DHS decrease the burden on counties? Wouldn't a proper level of need process also eliminate the burden on counties? Why is there a financial incentive for the broker to downcode recipients into ATS and then receive a fee when they set up the rides for those downcoded recipients in the ATS program? This seems to be a serious conflict of interest in my mind. I believe the reason the workload has increased so significantly is because the level of need process is flawed. As I previously mentioned, there is no such thing as ATS wheelchair transportation. Wheelchair transportation, again, is regulated by either MnDOT, the Department of Public Safety, not DHS. In fact, the ATS program was originally designed for ambulatory persons where there are minimal vehicle requirements, minimal driver requirements, and minimal capital requirements, thus justifying the lower rate that ATS pays. To suddenly force wheelchair users into the ATS program is causing the appeals and is contributing to the burden the counties are facing. What is essentially happening is this bulletin is forcing providers into providing SDS services at ATS reimbursement rates. This is not feasible because of the tremendous investment required to have a MnDOT-certified vehicle and a MnDOT-certified driver to provide this service. It is simply economically infeasible in the rural parts of Minnesota. In fact, one interesting point is the PMAP programs that serve rural parts of Minnesota have no such thing as wheelchair ATS. If you go out to do a ride for an ATS ambulatory ride for a PMAP and they are in a wheelchair, one phone call to that PMAP and they will switch that person back to SDS. In closing, I'd like to say that the counties have been providing ATS transportation, as I said, for a number of years. And the sudden, why now the sudden push to the brokered system, I believe, is based on the bulletin and some of the ways that the rules have been changed in that. DHS has been changing the rules arbitrarily, in my opinion, for the past 5 years in an attempt to establish the broker in this state, and I believe the system is getting worse, as Ms. Remish has indicated. I believe that there was one woman from Scott County that said that they are taking that upon themselves, and I think that is an excellent model. And I think that that model in itself can be used statewide in the rural parts of the state, that county governments working in conjunction with regional providers can solve these problems at a local level and more cost effectively. The good news is that the industry believes that we have the solutions. I've been approached by several lawmakers to participate in a work group this summer and into the fall. I understand that a number of providers and also MnDOT is interested in joining us in that endeavor, and I believe that if we pursue that, that we can come to some realistic solutions for this industry and put some of these issues to rest once and for all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pinsky, for your testimony. I'm troubled by your continued concerns regarding level of need. I had hoped that we had made some improvements and some movement in that area. So, Mr. Pinsky, my question is this. As a representative of a large group of these providers, have you seen improvements in the level of need process in the last 12 months or not?
Madam Chair, absolutely not. We believe that the process is still in need of significant improvement. As Ms. Remish indicated, that you have some of the most severely disabled people being denied access to their medical services here in the state of Minnesota to the point where their condition is deteriorating. And I don't think there's anybody that sees that as an improvement.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Pinsky, if you would just stay at the table for a moment. I'd like to take the opportunity to invite Ms. Reisdorf to rejoin us. And I've got a couple of questions that I'm hoping you can help us with. It was Mr. Pinsky's testimony that there are gaps in coverage during the appeal process. And I wonder if you can offer us some clarification or address that so that the committee has an understanding of what the rules are, what the process is. Are there gaps in coverage?
Madam Chair, I think that's something that I would want to check on. I mean, our concern is that if someone is certified, that certification should continue until the appeal process is done. if someone is coming in for the first time and requests a STS level of need, we can't certify that person until the appeal process is done. But that is something that I will check on, because if other kinds of services, too, services continue until the appeal process has been completed.
Ms. Reisdorp, thanks for the clarification. I know we'll appreciate the follow-up. That was my understanding, that during the appeal process, that service was, in fact, continued. Mr. Pinsky?
Madam Chair, what we're experiencing when somebody appeals is that there is a appeals process, of course, and that's where Ms. Remish comes in. However, it's my understanding, and it would be my criticism of the department, that they do not make that very clear to the recipient when they respond with their denial letter. We feel that the system could be improved significantly, that if a recipient showed an intent to appeal, that perhaps there would be some paperwork included with that, or at least an outlining of who to contact. In many instances, we were noticing that they're receiving the denial from MTM or MNET. And again, I'll go back to, I believe that MNET has a vested interest in keeping them at the ATS level and perhaps are making this overly difficult than it needs to be. But this, if somebody is appealing, I believe that they should have maintained their current level that they were downcoded from until the appeal is complete. The appeals in some instances, I believe, are being completed on a fairly expedited basis, but even if they do take a period of 30 or 45 days, a person's health condition without having access to the proper medical care during that time can deteriorate much quickly than just providing the service to ensure that until we get a bottom line answer from DHS.
Well, we'll appreciate the clarification on that, Ms. Reisdorf.
And just to follow up on Senator that, I would be very interested to see the format in which it is communicated that an appeal has been denied and whether or not the content in a letter indicates the appeal process and the right to retain their current level of service during the appeal process, and whether or not that comes from MNET or if that comes from the department. Because I understand, I know I've communicated this to the department, that in some communications between MNET and the recipient, that the person on the phone, the central location, wherever it's located in the United States, tells them not to bother to appeal because they have all the data they need. So there's been complaints that have come to my desk that not only is the denial given, but that the communication, at least verbal communication, is to not bother to appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Pinsky, quickly.
Madam Chair, the reason why I say that is because we have recipients who are being downcoded or contacting our office and asking what to do. And so we are obviously assisting them in giving them the appropriate places to contact. So I think that there should be a clarification in that process.
Okay. Well, continuing on, Ms. Reisdorf, Mr. Pinsky indicated that in some cases in his area, he suggests that the provider could, in fact, coordinate the service, and that is in the model where the department is assessing, making that level of need determination, and then the provider would be coordinating and following up and with scheduling. Do you have any thoughts about that, or does that doesn't seem to fit in the it doesn't seem to be fitting with the outline of the parameters in the bulletin? Ms. Reisdorf.
Madam Chair, regarding the STS level of need, I think more than 50% of the time, MNET does coordinate with the provider to clarify things or to get confirmation of the information that the client has said, because oftentimes they may not be aware of their own diagnosis or their own conditions. But so a lot of times they do collaborate and get information, additional information from the provider. Years ago, we did rely on a certification from the physician. That process, because physicians don't understand the difference between ATS and STS, that process was unworkable. And physicians signed forms, not really realizing what they were signing. The forms were being filled out by transportation providers, clinics were being harassed by transportation providers to sign the forms. It was not working well.
I think in conclusion, Ms. Reisdorf, it would be helpful to follow up with the division on what the eligibility criteria are for ATS, what the eligibility criteria for STS is, and what the level of need rubric is. I feel like those are questions that we have that have surfaced before. I think that attempts have been made in the past to try to work through some of those issues. And while I think there have been, in some cases, it was indicated today that there were some improvements and there are some things that are working well, I think that it's equally clear that there still remains a lot of questions and a lot of ambiguity out there. And I, for one, am not yet convinced that we're able to work through this on our own accord. So I would invite you, Ms. Reisdorf, as well as any of the testifiers today, any of those that are interested in this issue, you've heard the testimony again. If there are suggestions out there, we need those. And I don't think that we're interested in waiting for another 12 or 15-month period to go by and having a hearing like this once again. So I'll just issue that invitation, and we'll look forward to getting some good response. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Lynch, and I appreciate this hearing as well. I think we've gone through a lot of different subjects. I think I want to separate out, though, at least in my mind, that ATS services and STS services are two different things. We have the issue of the level of need assessment and serious concerns about errors in judgment that are occurring with a centralized level of need assessment that has may have a motivation, and that may not be valid, but certainly there's an appearance of a conflict of interest in the process of allowing one system to be paid for all of the assessments and the determinations. So that's one set of issues. The other set of issues is what level of service, once somebody's determined to be an ATS level of service, what should be provided to that person? How much can they do on their own? Is it reasonable to, is the safety issue of the transportation system of ATS something the county should be concerned about? If so, maybe we need to get some language into law that better defines and has requirements on ATS in terms of what they have to do for licensing or approval. If we don't want to do that, then we ought to let the perhaps let the customer make their selections and choose without government in being involved in determining whether they're properly licensed or prepared, because those rules are not in law right now. The other thing that we need to do is maybe talk further in some of the meetings that we might have in the future about this concept that one size fits all in terms of how to manage STS or ATS services throughout the state, and how what might work well in a densely populated area and might make sense there does not make sense in the rural part of the area, and that we continue to be concerned that we not use the statewide resources to fund a service that only makes sense in a metro area and not in the rural part of the state. So those are some of the things that I would want to continue to work on as we move forward to try to improve coordinating all. I just love the conversation from Scott County about integrating the silos between all of the different forms of service. That's great learning that we can gather from them.
Okay, great. Well, again, members, thank you for your time today. To those in the audience, thank you for your interest and ongoing assistance with this. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.